issue of arrogance and self-delusion that comes to people, and God's attitude towards all this, which, again, he's very dead set against it. The arrogant, point 20, is where we left off here, are very subject to self-delusion and are particularly objects of God's discipline and judgment, as seen in any number of verses. James, the one of the last one, we've looked at all the rest of them. This is consistent throughout the Old and New Testament, James 4, 6. And this one, obviously the arrogant, negative unbelievers God's opposed to, there's no doubt. But this is addressed to believers. And believers who are in some form of spiritual difficulty, they seem to, as James addresses them here, and be in some form of reversionism. They seem to love the cosmos, which is definitely a bad thing. That they are hostile to God, that they're not having their prayers answered, so that they've become enemies of God. So this is not just addressed to a believer who stumbled momentarily. This is addressed to some believers with some deep-seated issues. James 4, 6, but he gives a greater grace. Therefore, it says God is opposed. The word opposed there, again, is antichimai. It is a military term. And it means to lie against. It actually means, has the idea of laying siege in some instances to something, to a city. And so one of the more literal translations has translated, God surrounds the haughty and attacks. He arrays himself in battle formation. But he gives grace to the humble. And so God obviously takes this very seriously. And then James issues a series of commands to them in order to facilitate their spiritual recovery that is, goes beyond just simple rebound. Obviously, if these were just incidental sins, that he would just tell them to rebound. That's seen in the cleanse your hands, you sinners. But the purify your hearts, you double-minded, means that they've got more deep-seated issues that have to be addressed. And then James 13 through 16, come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to such and such a city and spend a year there and engage in business and make a profit. This is the exact kind of arrogance and boasting of talking about the end of a project before it's even begun that Solomon is addressing. Yet you do not know what your life will be like tomorrow. You are just a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and do this or that. But as it is, you boast in your arrogance, and all such boasting is evil. Therefore, to him who knows the right thing to do and does not do it, to him it is sin. And this gets into this verse, and again, it should not be isolated, verse 17, from the immediate context of arrogance and this idea that people have. And you don't have to get legalistic about it. I mean, I've been in some churches, you know, the book of James was taught, and for a while all you hear people say, well, if the Lord wills, blah, blah, blah. You don't have to preface everything with the Lord wills. Hopefully you know that that's just a reality. And saying it doesn't mean you mean it anyway. So, you know, you don't have to say, well, God willing, about everything you do. I mean, hopefully you know that it's contingent upon God's will. So, again, the arrogant here are subject to self-delusion. They are easily deluded. They're deluded with respect to their own position before God, in fact. Well, 21, Solomon goes on in verse 9 now to link the subject of anger with the previous subject of arrogance and impatience. This prohibition is then followed by an explanation which should serve as a motive for avoiding sinful anger. 22, as with all emotions, there is a sinful expression of anger, which one exhibits under the sin nature, and a righteous form of anger, which we call righteous indignation. With any of the emotions, as you study them, you'll see that in the Scripture there is an appropriate expression of them. God is indignant every day. So is God sinful? No, clearly not. There is sanctified jealousy, sanctified boasting, sanctified anger. All these things which would be normally considered, quote, negative things, there are appropriate expressions of them. But one has to, one, know what they are, and two, make sure that they do not deteriorate into inappropriate STA activity. So 20, the form of the prohibition, 23 here rather, is one that is generally used for immediate prohibitions, which are designed to check an activity already in progress. And again, normally that would be translated, stop being eager in your heart to be angry. But again, 24, however, it seems to this point in the book when Solomon offers a prohibition in this form, it is to be understood as extending to a permanent prohibition. The sense would be stop doing it now and do not do it in the future. 25, the fact that patience is better than arrogance is further explained by the admonition of verse 9, which is reinforced in the traditional teachings on anger, Proverbs 12:16. And this is one of the things that puzzles, of course, some of the interpreters as they look at this, and they think, well, Ecclesiastes, in some cases, it goes right along, agrees 100% with conventional wisdom, and in other cases, it throws conventional wisdom out the window. Well, and that's the point that, again, conventional wisdom, proverbs are addressed to limited situations. They're not always true in all situations, and Solomon recognized that. Proverbs 12:16, a fool's anger is known at once, but a prudent man conceals dishonor. And for many people, all you have to do to get them angry is just tell them no. Just cross them once. Just say no to them. And that's all it takes for some people to set them off. Just suggest to them they don't know what they're talking about. And that'll set them off. And I've observed people like this that are quick to anger, that they blow up over the least little thing. I mean, all of us have lost our temper. I recognize it. That's a sin. We've all done it. But there are people who are prone to this activity, that engage in it on a regular basis. And that is the challenge, of course, for believers, is to recognize it, deal with it, and not just say, well, everybody gets mad. Well, that's true. But these verses indicate that God's not impressed with this activity, doesn't sanction it, and in fact judges it. He's against it. So again, 16, a prudent man conceals dishonor. And you watch these people like this that lose their cool, and immediately, I mean, within 5 minutes, they're angry, they're hollering. It's not pleasant. I mean, I've lost my temper and acted like an idiot. Everybody probably has. And you don't see it. I mean, of course, the problem is you can't see yourself when you're doing it. You're not outside observing it. But then I've observed it in other people, and I think, oh, boy, that's not attractive. And now, you know, it's a lesson I take to heart and say, well, this is how God sees me when I do this. It's not pleasant. It's not appropriate. Proverbs 14:17 also. A quick-tempered man acts foolishly, but a man of evil devices is hated. And also here, 29:11. A fool always loses his temper. But a wise man holds it back. And also the verse we actually quoted before Bible class today, James 1:19, which is an exhortation in respect to specifically the issue of taking in doctrine, that anger and the associated bitterness, whatever stems from that, is not the appropriate way to approach God's plan. This you know, my beloved brethren, but everyone must be quick to hear, slow to speak and slow to anger, for the anger of man does not achieve the righteousness of God. So again, recognize, and you can put your own name in there, the anger of blank does not achieve the righteousness of God. It's not going to accomplish anything. God doesn't need human anger to advance his plan. 26, the one who is eager in his heart to be angry refers to the type of individual that evidences little self-control, a one who is quickly and easily provoked. And again, for a lot of people, I've noticed all you've got to do is disagree with them and they're provoked. That all you've got to do is say, no, I don't agree with that. And that sets them off. And I guess the only thing I can think about is that, well, perhaps they think they're right about everything. And anybody that disagrees with them must, by definition, be wrong. But, again, why so angry? This doesn't advance God's plan. Even if I'm off base, You know, how are you getting ahead by being angry at me? How does that solve the problem? How does that address it even? It doesn't. So 27, there can be little doubt that Solomon recognized the damaging effects of anger on the innermost portion of our lives, since anger often leads to bitterness, resentment, and a host of other related sins. And again, these things may exist in the mental attitude. It's called the root of bitterness. It may be unseen for some time, but it will eventually sprout given enough water and soil and fertilizer. It will become evident. It will become verbal, and it will go overt. So these things, again, these are damaging to people. They recognize even medically that certain people, because they're prone to anger, have certain physical problems that they bring upon themselves. Now, again, you can't take an extreme position in any of this. You can't take the extreme position that everybody that's sick has some sin problem. That's the foolish position Job's friends took. Bad things are happening to you. It must be because you're sinning. Well, that's dumb. The whole book of Job undermines that principle. And not all sickness is of a sin problem. But the fact is, some of it is. And some people bring certain things on themselves. They have certain problems. People with these chronic headaches and chronic problems probably have some chronic issue they're not dealing with spiritually. Whether it's impatience, whether it's anger, whether it's worry. Some people worry themselves into sickness because they're just constantly anxious about stuff. They won't deal with it. Some people, I think, get into all kinds of physical problems because of rejection of authority. There are lots of sins that can get you into trouble. And some of them even have an effect on the physical body. I'm convinced that people with chronic long-term problems probably have an issue or two that they're not dealing with. I've observed people over the years, and it doesn't mean you have to be perfectly healthy. I don't think any of us are 100% healthy all the time. You can't be, for one thing. I mean, if you never got sick, if you were, you know, immune to everything, you know, as it were, the immune system never gets built up, the first bug that came along would kill you. So, obviously, you know, again, I try not to judge people, but certain people over the years, having known them and having known their STA deals and their physical maladies, the two to me appear to be related. I'm not saying this is true of every believer, but there is a specific class of believer that I do believe this is true of. There are types of people like this. So 28 here, therefore one is advised to be patient and not quickly take offense. The wise man will not react with anger apart from sufficient and prolonged provocation. Now, that's not to say that there's never a point and a time where the response should be to tell these people to shut up. Knock it off. Quit it. I'm not putting up with this any longer. There is a point at which that happens. But you should extend, again, the general principle is you grace people out and give them time to pull their horns in. Now, if they just refuse to pull their horns in, well, that you can't stop, obviously. And then at some point, you'll have to deal with that. So the prudent man conceals dishonor there in verse 16. He holds it back. The wise man holds back. He doesn't quickly give in to this stuff. And so this is the challenge. I mean, this addresses us all right where we live, because all of us get angry. And sometimes, what is it that sets you off? It's earth-shaking stuff, right? No. You can be at home, you know, you can be at home dealing with husband and wife issues and stuff. You can have a fight over salt and pepper. I just pick salt and pepper. I haven't had one recently over that, but you never know. You know, hand me the pepper and throws it at me. No, that obviously would be a different deal, but you never know what can start a fight. What's going to make you angry? The least little thing can set you off. And nobody ever knows what it's going to be. And again, generally, I've watched, and typically it's not earth-shaking stuff that people get angry and fight about. It's not as though the plan of God needs us to defend every little aspect of it anyway. God's plan did just fine before you got here, thank you very much. And it'll do just fine once you're gone. So the arrogant person assumes he's got to protect God. Well, how are you going to protect God, and from what? I think God's okay. I think he can protect himself. Our job is simply, again, in some cases, to just deal with the small stuff that eats our lunch and to handle that. But if you're provoked, you know, obviously if there's a prolonged series of provocations that just continue to escalate and become more and more provoking, at some point you're going to have to deal with that. You're not going to put up with it forever. 29, these two verses are the first time that Solomon has used the term ruach, breath, wind, or spirit, to refer to the higher nature of man. To this point, he has used it of the wind or breath. 30, it would appear that he is using the term here, or at least the phrase, in the sense of inclination. Therefore, his point is that one should not be inclined toward anger. When he talks about eager in your heart to be angry, in your spirit to be angry, that it has the idea of your normal inclination. Some people have an inclination to be angry. That's the sin they fight. It may or may not, it appears it might be more prevalent in men, but that's not to say it is. But men are prone to certain sins that women don't necessarily, it's not to say they never fail at it or anything, but they're prone to certain sins that women aren't subject to. And women are prone to sins sometimes that men aren't subject to. But the idea here is, again, some people are inclined to do this. This is their MO. You know them by the way they're going to, you know that they're going to get angry. If they're crossed at any level, you know they're going to get mad, and you know they're going to react. And again, all you have to do sometimes is just tell them no. And that's enough to set them off. Or just disagree with them. I disagree. I've thought about this, and I disagree with your assessment. Well, 31, or therefore his point is that one should not be inclined towards anger. 31, his explanation, which forms the motive for not being so inclined, is that anger resides in the bosom of fools. 32, the Hebrew term nuach, rests, not only denotes the absence of movement from a place, it emphasizes being settled down with some overtone of finality. 33, the force of the Hebrew text is that anger is completely at home within the fool, who has embraced the sin to the point that it is said to be within his chest cavity. 34, the unwise person is one that gives immediate expression to his anger. The type of person that has been overcome by his refusal to control his anger. And for some people, again, the more you give in to this sin, the more it comes to dominate you. That it can be fought, like any sin. And again, you recognize that there is a certain advance you make in the Christian life in terms of not sinning as much in certain areas. It was taught for some time in doctrinal circles, it's incorrect. Sin isn't an issue in the Christian life. I beg to differ. Yes, it is. If it isn't, why do we have all these prohibitions to not sin? Of course it's an issue. It's an issue because of righteousness. And as a growing believer, you ought to see some progress. Now, the progress may not come overnight. It's probably not going to. But there are certain sins as you grow and as you mature, you say, okay, I see, I don't sin in that area as much as I used to. Now, that's not to say tomorrow you can't go out and blow it in that area. You might. But you ought to be making some progress in that regard. And the person that gives in to any sin on an ongoing basis becomes more likely to commit that sin. Just pick the sin. And anger is one of these that eats people's lunch because they just tend to give in to it. Because for one thing, you know, there's certain sins in our culture that are acceptable and certain sins that aren't. Anger is one of those kind of acceptable sins. Oh, everybody gets mad. And so people just kind of blow it off. But of course, anger, as we're going to see, we're going to review the doctrine of anger. Anger is mental attitude murder. Now, we don't think murder is acceptable. Well, before God, neither is mental attitude anger. It's just as bad as overt murder. But most people, again, the fundies, do not emphasize the mental attitude sins, which are what eat people's lunch. They are far and away more prevalent than the even verbal sins, and certainly more prevalent than overt sins. But certain sins in our culture are sort of accepted. Well, this is just the way life is. But they shouldn't be among believers. So again, the more you give in to anger, the more likely you are to be angry. And you should make some progress in this. And if you don't see some progress in this, well, then it's something you need to work on. It's an area of weakness. And granted, let's say you've got, we'll just pick a number. I don't know how many sins you could possibly commit, but you've got 10 areas in your STA, 1 through 10. 1 being the one you commit the most often, and 10 being the area in your STA where you don't fail very much. And these sins up here, obviously, the top three or four, are the ones that eat your lunch. These are the ones where the battle's really fought. But over the years, you ought to see these diminishing in some ways. You ought to have a desire to see them diminish. The adjusted, positive believer hates his sin nature. And he hates sinning. He recognizes it doesn't pay anything. It's not of any value. It doesn't advance God's plan. And all it brings on him is discipline, death, and misery. Oh my. This is what you get out of it. This is the deal. The STA promises you liberty and brings you slavery. The STA promises you happiness and brings you misery. Oh, if I do this, I'll be happy. And it's never true. It doesn't pay. Sin never makes people happy. So these areas you have to work on. These are the ones where the real fight is fought. And you may have some sin. This one may dog you to the, and it probably will, to the very end of your life. You may fight it every day. But that's the key. You fight it. You don't give in to it. You don't capitulate to it. You don't quit rebounding it. Well, I've committed this sin too many times. I can't rebound. Oh, that's what I read in the Bible. Never rebound if you commit a sin more than three times. No. What did Jesus teach? When Peter comes to, hey, Lord, you know, Peter thinks he's being gracious. Is Peter misguided, as usual? I'm being gracious. Lord, how often shall I forgive my brother sin against me and I forgive him? Seven times? Because the rule of that day was one, two, three strikes, you're out. Just like it is today in a lot of cases. It was one, two, and the third time they jammed you, you could uncork on them. Revenge was accepted. And so Peter says, oh, okay, hey, seven times I forgive? He said, no, but I tell you, you got to forgive your brother 70 times seven. And that doesn't mean count up 490 sins. And then jam it. That's not what he's saying. It's an expression for totality. As it were, perfect forgiveness. You got to keep forgiving him. And if God expects that out of his children, what does God do? He does the same thing. You cannot afford to fall into the mental attitude, oh, I've committed this sin too much, I can't rebound it. You better keep rebounding it. Because that's the only thing that keeps you spiritually in fellowship, for one thing. And it's also the only thing that means that you're actually still attempting to deal with it. When you quit rebounding a sin, you're dead in the water. You've entered into some form of reversionism if you don't rebound it. That's one of the things I recognize, because I'm reviewing that doctrine and updating it. The reversionist doesn't rebound his sins. He commits sins on an ongoing basis that he does not rebound. And so he spends more and more and more time out of fellowship. And he perpetuates carnality, and perpetuated carnality is reversionism. And so, if God expects us to forgive an infinite number of times, he's going to forgive us an infinite number of times. I don't know if you've ever gotten into the guilt trip. Oh, I've committed this sin too many times. I don't want to rebound. I feel guilty for rebound. Why would you feel guilty for rebounding? Rebounding's an imperative, as it were. You've got to rebound. Just that, I'm such a, can you imagine the unbeliever? Maybe there are people out here like this that come, I'd like to believe the gospel, but I'm such a horrible person, God wouldn't save me. Paul said, look, he set me forth as an example. The most horrible man on the planet he saved anyway. The greatest sinner. And I don't think Paul was exaggerating for the sake of effect. I think he really was. But the point is, God can save anybody. The point is, God can forgive any sin. You can't quit rebounding it. You say, well, that just is a so I can sin and rebound, yes. But is that the approach you want to take to the Christian life? And that's not the correct approach. And that's why the fundies are very double-minded about this. Because they out of one side of their mouth, they say eternal security. And out of the other side of their mouth, they say, but you can't sin. Well, good luck on that one. And they are so double-minded about this. Once you're saved, you're always saved. Well, you can't just sin and rebound it. Yes, you can. But now, that's not the proper attitude to have. Well, I'm just going to sin and rebound it. And that's why a lot of the fundies out there, they don't like the idea of rebound even. They say, well, that just is a license to sin. No, it's a license to get back in fellowship. You can't produce divine good. You can't advance spiritually if you're out of fellowship. And I look at this, and I reflect on this in my own life. And I look at it, and I think, this is just so simple. Everything about Christianity is painfully simple. What do you have to do to be saved? Jump through 19 hoops? Have a high IQ? Know the right people? No, believe in the Lord Jesus Christ and you will be saved. It's simple. Why can't the negative unbelievers get it? They don't want to get it. How simple is rebound? What do I got to do to get back in fellowship? Confess my sin. And how simple is that? And yet, believers don't even do that. Now go figure. That's why they're going to be without excuse in that day. There's not going to be any excuses anybody can offer. I couldn't believe it was too hard. I couldn't rebound. I couldn't get in fellowship. No, you chose not to. That's what the real issue is. It's your volition. So you keep fighting. You don't give in to the sins. You may commit them. And you're going to commit them. This is the sad reality of Christianity for right now in time. You're going to commit sins. You're a sinner. Just as sure as the orange tree produces oranges and the apple tree produces apples, you're going to commit sins. But again, you have to recognize them for what they are. And only you can do that. Only you can fight this fight. Some men's sins are obvious. And if you've got an obvious area in your STA, you might almost want to be thankful for that. Because the more subtle sins, some people don't even realize they're committing them. The obvious sins, well, at least you know you committed it. You gossiped, you maligned, you slandered, you had a bad attitude, you were bitter, you were hateful, and this or that. Hopefully nobody here is murdered, but if you murder somebody, it's a sin, you rebound it. So, again, 70 times 7 is the forgiveness factor. And if God does it, then we have to do it. Let's see, where did we get here? Yeah, the anger, the fool, the anger, he's refused to control it. He gives into it. He's quit fighting the fight at a certain level, the fool. The fool is a person that's not recognizing this and dealing with it. And think of all the sins that reversionists commit. They skip Bible class, they don't rebound, they're not praying, and they're probably not financially supporting what they're probably not handling their finances right, they're not making that application. You think of all the applications they can't make and aren't making, and all the prohibitions they're breaking, not forsaking the assembling of yourselves together. But do they rebound that every Bible class? No, they're going to quit rebounding that after a point. And they're going to feel justified. But they're in reversionism, plain and simple. So 35, while it may not appear that the subject matter of verse 10 has anything to do with this context, it would very readily apply to the person that was angry with the course of this present life and longed for a, quote, better time. 36, certainly the general meaning of the verse is apparent. It is an admonition not to glorify the past over the present. And the older you get, the easier this becomes to do. Because the older you get, the more you forget what really was like when you were young. But when you were young, you had a lot more energy, and you had a lot more time, and you had a lot more freedom. You didn't have certain responsibilities and all that. And it's easy to look back and say, ah, the good old days. And in certain cases, the good old days may really have been the good old days. Maybe they really were better. But it addresses an issue of maladjustment to the current life. When people are living in the past. That is one of the signs of the emotional revolt of the soul, is living in the past. The Exodus generation typifies this. The continual refrain, oh, I want to go back to Egypt. All we got here is manna. We had garlics and onions and leeks. We had pots of meat. You were slaves. And yet they longed for the, quote, good old days of slavery. Well, those weren't really the good old days, were they? They're misguided and maladjusted. So certainly, again, the general meaning is very apparent. 37, Solomon has already addressed the fact that there is nothing new under the sun, and that each generation is simply replaced by another generation. We've seen these verses 1, 4, and 9, and also in 3:15. That it's just an endless cycle, a parade of human beings coming on the scene and human beings going off the scene. The generation comes and the generation goes. And this is always, again, the human race is being ever renewed and ever perishing at the same time. Well, 38, he never suggests that any generation has an advantage over any other generation. He merely points out that one replaces the previous one, and it will be replaced by the next one, and so on. And 39, one obvious flaw in the thinking of the person that longs for the good old days is the good old days are what has led them to the bad present days. How did you get here to the bad present days? Well, the good old days brought you here. So the past is what formed the basis for the reality of the present. And if the present's bad, well, maybe the past wasn't as good as you remember it. And you look back and you think, ah, the good old days when gas was 35 cents a gallon. And we said, oh, they'll never get it to a dollar. And yeah, they did. And hamburgers were 20 cents. Cokes were a nickel. Ah, the good old days. And, you know, of course, minimum wage was $1.60. You know. So, you know, people tend to forget, too, about what really the good old days were. They weren't always as good as they are made out to be. Well, 40, therefore, how good could they have been in reality if they brought us to where we are now? Time keeps marching on. In 41, some people think that the past must certainly have been better than the present. And they tend to romanticize some previous generation as being superior to the generation in which they lived. 42, for instance, the first generation of the church age is viewed by some people as being superior to the time in which we live, since believers there were far more, quote, spiritual. Well, guess what? They weren't. They had the same problems you and I have. You look at James, you read his book, you read the books to the Corinthians, even to the Thessalonians. People are maladjusted, they're arguing in church, they're fighting about this or that, they're under their STAs, they're bitter, they're in danger of going into reversionism. This doesn't sound like to me, you know, anything different than what I've got today. It's the same STA problems, is it not? It's the same issue of fighting a good fight. And I hear people, oh, if we just lived in the time of Acts. Oh, idiot. Please, I'll take inside plumbing any day. The good old days, oh yes, there was no toilets. The good old days, no electricity. And I was talking to Jack Ballinger the other day. He said, you know, they had the big ice storm there in Oklahoma and they were without power for a week. He said, once the sun went down, it was just miserable. You know. There's no lights in the house. You couldn't do anything. He said, your day was over once the sun went down. Oh, the good old days. Day's over when the sun goes down. And you rise at the crack of dawn and get out and plow those fields. Oh, you didn't have a tractor. You had to have an ox and walk behind him. And, to get point A to point B, there were no cars or motorcycles or, you know, Segways. You know, it was walk. Everywhere you went, walk, 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 walk. Did you think I ever got tired of walking? Probably. How far could you go in a day? You couldn't travel a real long ways. I mean, going to visit somebody that lived very far was out of the question. I mean, you know, to take a trip, you know, say from here to Oklahoma or Texas, and we're only talking halfway across the country. What if you wanted to visit somebody in California? How long would it take you to walk there? Well, you better have a lot of time and a lot of money. And then again, you know, when you're traveling out there, you know, it isn't like they had hotel rooms with locks on the doors and all that. As dangerous as it is traveling now, do you imagine what it was like traveling in those days? The good old days, yeah. And the believers were no better off. You look at the early church in Jerusalem, what's the first thing we see out of them? A big fight about from the liberal liberal Jews fighting against the Orthodox Jews because their widows are being neglected. And so we get the office of deacon out of one of the problems that the church endured. And oh, they shared all things together. Okay, well, we can do that. You want a common bank account? Sign everything over. Let's join the compound. Drink the Kool-Aid. No, I don't think so. I don't think that's necessarily superior. I like the fact that, you know, you have your own freedom and privacy and all that. I mean, obviously, we share with one another and can get together and fellowship and do all that just like they did. But why did some of those things happen? Well, one reason is that they were so committed to the apostles' teaching that nobody was deviating from it, that they were following it very, very closely. And this, all this fellowship and all this, quote, wonderful time came out of orientation and adherence to doctrine. It didn't come accidentally. But you got people today, they want to do it their way, they got their own ideas, and they wonder why things aren't quite as good as they used to be. Well, I can tell you why. You've deviated from the doctrine. So no, you're not going to have the same exact stuff. Well, 43, however, this nonsense is easily and quickly dispelled by a careful study of the book of Acts and the epistles written in the first century. which clearly set forth the same flaws and weaknesses of believers that lived then as can be observed in believers today. Maladjustment to prophecy, that's what 2 Thessalonians is all about. Being duped by false teachers. Throwing people out of the church, that's what 1 Timothy's all about. All these problems that you observe today are the same problems that you had then. There's not anything new under the sun. Beyond that, point 44, look, churches face many of the same problems we see today in local churches. These include immorality, laziness, bitterness, failure to forgive, marital problems, rejection of certain doctrines, infiltration by those teaching false doctrine, rejection of authority, and more. But yeah, I can point you to an epistle that has every one of these things in it. And more. You see the incestuous Corinthian. Can you imagine how most local churches react to that today? I mean, this poor guy, he'd never get back in Bible class in some cases, in some instances, among some groups. He'd never be allowed to recover. And God help you if you ever have a marital problem. You know, all that. Some people want to write people off for one failure. And it's just one failure at some level. Is it serious? Well, sure. We're not trying to minimize it. But, you know, you have these people that wouldn't forgive each other. You say there, I saw there and say in Philippians, Euodia and Syntyche, or as one funny guy called her, odious and soon touchy. They couldn't get along. That was a joke. Paul says, hey, help these women to try to get along. They had the same problems you got in churches. People have to want to. And you can't, that's the thing, as a leader, you can't provide the want to. That has to be there on its own. That's a factor of your volition. Well, 45, another reason people tend to glorify the past is due to the fact that the passing of time tends to cause people to forget the bad things, gloss over minor inconveniences, and exaggerate whatever good things did happen in the good old days. And you hear people talk about the good old days like it was just the most wonderful time. And you don't hear about the bad things that happened. Oh yeah, what about World War II? That was kind of bad, wasn't it? Ah, the Roaring Twenties. What about the stock market crash of 29? Was it really that great a time? What about the Depression? And all of that. And you can look back, you know. You look. Somebody sent me a deal, you know, the 50s and the 60s and what life was really like. And, you know, were there some stronger role models? Yes, I agree, there were. You know, television shows were, you know, the dad was normal. He wasn't a bumbling idiot all the time. Every show I see today, the dad's just a bumbling idiot. The only one with any sense is the woman, of course, who runs things. And generally runs it because the man is so stupid he doesn't even know what's happening. And I'm talking about shows even that have advanced, you know, I don't know if you've seen it, but Tyler Perry, he's a believer. And he makes some pretty decent movies that advocate Christian principles and all that. But I watch his television show, and the dad's just a bumbling idiot. And I thought, well, he doesn't have much respect for black men to portray him just like every other idiot out there. But you go back and you watch Father Knows Best, huh? How come it wasn't called Mother Knows Best? It would be today. Or you watch Andy of Mayberry. You know, did he have strong norms and standards? Yeah. Did he recognize? Did he have some people skills and know how to handle things? Yeah. But, you know, you can't go back to the 50s. You can't turn the clock back, unfortunately. Was it better in the 50s when you didn't have to lock your doors and everything was safe? Yeah, probably. Now you got to lock everything up. You can't trust anybody. Well, but again, the good old. But what was it? You know, what about the good old days? You know, cars didn't have airbags. If you get in a wreck, you're going to probably appreciate that. There was all kinds of things, all kinds of technology we didn't have. You know, this was a calculator. Let alone a computer. Well, again, although some of the bad things, point 46, that had happened in the good old days have been forgotten, some of those very bad things may have resulted in serious spiritual growth and greater orientation to God in the present. So when you look back, you know, again, bad things happened. It's just that people tend to forget them. They tend to minimize them. The human being has an ability to tend to forget and minimize pain. Or women would never have more than one child. Because they, obviously they you have an ability to block out pain and to deal with it and move on and forget about it. Well, sometimes when bad things happen, though, let's say bad things did happen, have they not resulted in spiritual growth in some cases, in greater advance in doctrine? Well, that's a part of the good old days, is the bad things that happen too. 47, very often this type of thinking is found in those that are dissatisfied with the present circumstances. Forget or that's another whole thing. They forget, or else they're minimizing how good it is actually in the present. I mean, when people are miserable in their present circumstances, what does that say about them? They've got a problem. You can be happiness comes from within. If you're waiting for your niche to make you happy, don't hold your breath. It's not going to happen. It's orientation to your niche that produces inner happiness. It's willingness to do God's will in your niche that produces happiness. So again, they tend to forget or minimize their present blessings and exaggerate the glory of the past. 48, this type of person manifests a lack of contentment, a lack of gratitude, a lack of grace orientation, and a lack of respect for God's sovereign wisdom and control. And let's not forget all that. They're questioning God in all this. Oh, well, God let the good old days, and God didn't let those last. Well, was it God's choice or what that brought us here? Or was it our choices that got us here? And everybody probably looks back at certain times in their life and thinks, oh, man, that was a good time. I enjoyed that. I was contented during that time, or happy, or whatever else. Well, don't get too locked into that. That same contentment and happiness and all that you had then, you can have again. But some people, I guess, just figure they can't. Well, again, God's in control of all of this. He's got some wisdom. He's sovereign over all of it. 49, Solomon concludes by discouraging such activity with his observation that this type of thinking does not come from the source of wisdom. And 50, since it does not proceed from the source of wisdom, it likely proceeds from the source of folly. And marks the questioner as a fool. If it doesn't come from wisdom, where does it come from? Well, most likely it comes from something far less than wisdom. He says that this is not a wise way to live life. And again, this is a characteristic of those people under the emotional revolt of the soul. One of the factors, again, that comes to people as they enter into the reversionism process. Okay, well, we're going to stop there because I don't want to dive into that doctrine, so we will be ready to resume here with the doctrine of anger, so have that before you on Wednesday. Thank you, Father, for the privilege of studying these things. May God the Holy Spirit enlighten us in Christ's name. Amen.